Word, I'm gonna say the word.
In the beginning was the word.
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 Was the word.
From the studios of KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona, welcome to Word, a podcast about literature. Here's your host, Tom Maxedon.
Coming up on this episode of Word, a new play about two beloved film critics hits the stage soon in the Valley.
Siskel and Ebert were the faces of film as a consumer in the late 20th century.
Plus, Washington Post foreign affairs columnist and editor David Ignatius talks about his new fictional spy thriller, as well as real-world technology, which could threaten national security in the West.
Russia and China have developed a kill switch that could cripple the GPS system.
But first, professor and poet Jacqueline Balderrama is a fellow in residence at ASU's Virginia G. Piper Center and director of Canto Mundo. When we spoke last fall for a news story, she was planning a retreat, which is now upon us. For those who didn't hear that past interview, I asked her in a recent conversation to describe the mission of Canto Mundo and what's planned for the upcoming events with featured Latinx poets.
Canto Mundo is a national literary organization founded in 2009 that cultivates a community for Latinx poets. It means Song World, and is focused on celebrating the voices of Latinx communities from its elders to its youth. And to catch everyone up to speed, this is the first year it's in collaboration with the Virginia G. Piper Center for Creative Writing at ASU. And it's ASU where we're excited to be hosting the annual retreat at the end of this month, when Latinx poets from across the country will join in Tempe for workshops, panels, and readings.
That's going to happen Friday, May 31st and Saturday, June 1st, 7 to 8:30 p.m. both nights at the Memorial Union on the ASU Tempe campus. What kinds of things are going to occur?
Each night we'll have rapid readings from about 10 of the Canto Mundo Fellows. They're free and open to the public, and we really invite the local community to come. So, like I said, rapid readings from the Canto Mundo Fellows, who are emerging and established poets themselves, followed by our main headliners. So Friday, May 31st, we have Rodrigo Toscano. He's a poet, dialogist, and labor activist based in New Orleans, the author of 11 poetry books, and he won the Edwin Markham 2019 Prize for Poetry. He's also an incredibly dynamic speaker. I had the chance to hear him read maybe 2017 or 2018 at the University of Utah. His work is engaged at the intersections of poetry and theater.
Also, Yacina Montilla will be there as well.
Right. She's on June 1st. She's an Afro-Latina poet. She teaches at the Juilliard School and lives in Harlem, New York. Her most recent collection, Muse Found in a Colonized Body, which is from Four Way Books, was a finalist for the NAACP Image Award in 2023. That's the National Association for Advancement of Colored People. And I haven't met Montilla before, but she writes these moving poems expressing love and critique, and that are sort of exploring the intersection and that in-betweenness that so many children and grandchildren of immigrants may feel.
This is going to be different than a lot of these types of retreats where people just sort of show up for a performance or a reading or something, because as I understand, it's more kind of like a fair in a way, in that there's going to be books for sale.
Yeah, both of the readings are followed by receptions and book signings. So we'll have books not only by the headlining readers, but all the fellows, as well as some of the co-founders who will be attending and helping me run the retreat.
What do you hope people who attend might take away? I mean, obviously, there's going to be lots of people who know a lot about poetry, enjoy it, but maybe they'll bring a friend who doesn't have much exposure to it.
Right. I hope people come away with some great summer reading, for one. But really, I think this is the chance to experience firsthand what's happening in Latinx poetry from the vast variety of perspectives and experiences that that includes. With so many of these incredible poets in one space, I think there's really going to be something for everyone. I do hope attendees are introduced to a writer that they might not have known about before, that they're inspired to think more deeply about the beauty and power of language that we use, and I guess most of all, just have a good time.
Jacqueline, I want to thank you so much for coming to Word and talking to us about the Canto Mundo retreat that's happening at the end of the month.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure, and we really would invite people to join us.
You can find out a bit more about professor and poet Jacqueline Balderrama, as well as Canto Mundo, on our website, word.kjzz.org. Coming up, a new play about two beloved film critics hits the stage soon in the Valley. I'm Tom Maxidon, and you're listening to Word, a KJZZ podcast about literature.
You can get a lot of things delivered these days, and that includes the latest Arizona news from KJZZ's Sun Up podcast. I'm Phil Latzman. Everything you need to know to start each day delivered to you in this handy little podcast. Go to kjzz.org or wherever you get your podcasts and download KJZZ Sun Up today.
It's time to plan your summer road trip. If you have a vehicle that won't be a part of your trip to San Diego or Yellowstone, donate it to KJZZ. Find out more at cars.kjzz.org. And thanks.
It's getting hot out there, so you may be spending even more time indoors, or at least on the patio. Ask your smart speaker to play KJZZ for the news and entertainment. Keep cool and connected with your public radio station. Just say, play KJZZ, and your smart speaker becomes a radio.
Welcome back to Word. I'm Tom Maxidon. A play about two beloved film critics hits the stage soon in the Valley. It's called Roger and Jean, and was written by Valley-based playwright Ashley Naftool. The work is an absurdist and timely comedy about two familiar personalities, Roger Ebert and Jean Siskel, who are forced to navigate new territory in the landscape of film, which involves on-demand content and an increasing use of artificial intelligence. The show is led by Space 55 artistic director B.J. Garrett, who joined me recently to talk about it. He opened by discussing why he was attracted to Naftool's script.
These types of plays really speak to me because, number one, they're relevant. They're timely. They're about things that are happening in the now. But most of all, a lot of times we go see a play and it ends and we say, hey, that was fun. Who's hungry? And then that entertainment is consumed and then, you know, we move on, right? And sometimes there's a really special place in the world for making a piece of art that someone ingests and digests, and maybe it leaves that sensation in their tummy, right? That was so pleasant, we want to tell everyone about it. Or maybe it made us feel uncomfortable. Either way, we're going to tell our friends about it. We're going to tell our friends about what we saw, what we thought about. We're going to think about it. We're going to think about how that food made us feel, about that unique taste sensation. For me, anything that someone continues the conversation when they get in the car and they drive home, whether they felt really good or really bad or really uncomfortable.
Right.
You know, that's the stuff that I really like to explore. Like, let's make people feel something and continue to feel it after they walk out of the theater.
Well, we call those driveway moments on NPR and public media. Folks have them all the time. Listeners of KJZZ, for instance, often during our fundraising opportunities or just with an email, maybe they'll send us a message and just say, hey, I really appreciated that story, all the multiple perspectives. It keeps me coming back to listening to public radio. Roger and Jean is the title. This is an absurdist comedy about two very familiar film critics that I grew up watching, Roger Ebert and Jean Siskel. I'm hard-pressed to find another, not even just pair of folks like they were, but even just a lone critic that had the type of conversation about film and art that they did.
I think it's very true. And I think that's one of the things that kind of makes this script work too, is that Siskel and Ebert were the faces of film as a consumer in the late 20th century, right? Their reviews are on every movie cover, you know, two thumbs up. You see where they both agreed on something. You expected them to disagree on things. They had really intellectual conversations. They had really passionate arguments, but they were sort of a face of that generation.
This is set up in terms of if they had survived this long, but the world has changed around them. The media ecosystem is crumbling around them. The arts are being destroyed by artificial intelligence, but they're still holding on to their jobs as America's most beloved film critics. How do they adapt to this new landscape? And this kind of sets up a tension, right? Because if you don't have tension in a story, you don't have a story.
Yeah, and that is something that you experience as an audience member watching this, because this is not the world that they lived in before. So how would to critics like Siskel and Ebert that explore the nuances and the art and the deeper meaning of the films that they watched. How would they react to, you know, a version of Hollywood now that focuses a lot on the milking of intellectual properties and seeing how many iterations of a franchise we can crank out to maximize box office, where click revenue kind of supersedes the substance of art, where artificial intelligence is writing scripts and movie plots for us. As a director, I don't want to critique the output itself of those types of films. I enjoy a good Avengers or Expendables movie like the next person, but this super saturation of movies that are made as a form of commerce and art is like a secondary piece of that or even lesser focus. So what do you do when you're film critics who are trying to hang on to that love for art, that love for film, and you're seeing things sort of change before your eyes? And more than just a commentary on the substance of film, but what does the world look like when you're watching people who review films? Are you captured by watching a Siskel and Ebert, or do you need to crank up the conflict? Do you need to crank up the sensationalized, explosive moments that two people can have when reviewing a movie? So a lot of the tension in this play, a lot of the rising action really is about the two critics sort of realizing that things around them are not the way they remember. And the movies they're being asked to review, the ways in which they're being asked to review them, they're getting producer's notes that don't make any sense to them, that use a lot of technological buzzwords that they're not familiar with. And you start to see that this world that they're occupying now, this present day world with a somehow still alive Siskel and Ebert, isn't quite lining up in a way that makes a lot of sense.
Well, and I think that is a function of the absurdist genre, but I got to believe there's also lots of comedic moments in this.
This script is hysterically funny. One of the things I love about the way Ashley writes theater, Ash's works are some that I particularly admire because they have this really unique gift for presenting really timely, really important issues in this hilariously absurd but still thought-provoking way. And there's a lot of elements of slapstick that occur in this. There's large amounts of parody around the modern YouTube consumption experience, again, the way people consume art now. Really, the play at its core is meant to make you think about what you're seeing, but it's really funny throughout. It is a comedy at its core, and it's one, like a lot of other of Ashley's works, very funny, sharp, biting dialogue, great moments of just excellent physical comedy, all telling this really important message, but through this lens of an absolutely distorted reality. We're not beating you over the head with the moral of the story. This is meant to be a romp, and it is the whole way through.
Yeah, and I think comedy serves that purpose very well. It can be both instructive and humorous. Roger and Jean plays at Metro Arts from June 7th to June 16th. We've been talking to its director, BJ Garrett. Thank you so much for coming to Word.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having us, and look forward to seeing folks at the Playhouse.
You can find out a bit more about Roger and Jean and showtimes on our website, word.kjzz.org. Coming up, David Ignatius from The Washington Post talks about his new fictional spy thriller. I'm Tom Maxidon, and you're listening to Word, a KJZZ podcast about literature.
I'm Jay Ellison, producer of The Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us for our show here on KJZZ. With true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world, Moth shows are renowned for the range of human experience they reveal. Moth stories aren't part of the disposable daily information flow. They stick with you. The Moth Radio Hour airs Saturday at 3 on KJZZ.
Hey, I'm A. Martinez from Morning Edition.
And I'm Phil Latzman from Morning Edition on KJZZ.
We start our days early, really early, so you have the news you need to start your day.
Later, we take over. I'm Juana Summers from All Things Considered.
And I'm Tiara Vian from All Things Considered on 91.5.
Ease into your evening with us with updates on the biggest stories of the day
and the latest in music, arts, and science.
Listen to KJZZ 91.5 every weekday.
Welcome back to Word. I'm Tom Maxidon. Washington Post foreign affairs columnist and editor David Ignatius has a new fictional spy thriller titled Phantom Orbit. but the story includes technology that's based on very similar real-life applications, which could pose a serious threat to national security in the West. Welcome, David. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm just curious, did you ever imagine doing anything other than writing? You've been doing it for so long.
So that's a great question. I, in truth, wanted to be an economist, and I went to graduate school to study economics. And I had one of those horrible moments where you realize, well, I could keep doing this, but I won't be very good at it. So I turned course. The thing I'd done since I was in high school was to write newspaper articles. I did freelance for every publication around. I'd already written for the Washington Post, actually, when I was in graduate school. So I took a job. The first job I had was, you know, I'd gone to a fancy college. I'd been a graduate student in England. And my first job was covering the United Steelworkers Union, the largest industrial union in the country, in Pittsburgh. And it was just the best thing that ever happened to me because it taught me, you know, how to learn to talk to other people not like me. And I loved it. I was hooked. Never looked back.
Well, of course, you write in two worlds, fiction and reality. Which do you like more? And do you ever get confused between the two? I mean, sometimes it seems like we're living in a fictional world, often not of our own choosing. Like, we couldn't write some of the things that happened.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, if I tried to write a plot that had a character like Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, go down the list, people wouldn't believe it. The two worlds are mutually supporting. Everything that I write in my fiction begins with the reporting I've done in the real world. There are things that don't fit into an 800-word column that you want to unpack. You want to let them breathe and be as complicated as they are in real life. So I am able to do that in my fiction. My wife tells me if I ever stop writing columns, I'd be impossible to live with because I like that. You know, it's exciting. It's interesting. I feel like on that subject, a few others read what I have to say carefully. So I'd hate to give that up.
You've got a new thriller out called Phantom Orbit, and it centers on a character named Ivan Volkov. Tell me a little bit about who he is.
Ivan Volkov is a Russian, as you might imagine. We meet him in a prologue in real time, right now. The Ukraine war is going on. He's sitting in Moscow, and he's an astrophysicist. He spent his life working on satellites, and he comes to a judgment that Russia and China have developed what he thinks is a kill switch that could cripple the GPS system on which our cell phones, our air transport, our just about everything has some link to GPS. And he thinks the capability to take it down exists. And although he's not a spy, he just feels a responsibility to warn the United States. He contacts the CIA through their website. They've got an invitation to the whole world to send them information. He sends off his message, and nobody answers. He didn't get anything back. And through the course of the book, in different ways, people don't want to answer him. So why is that? What's going on? It's part of the puzzle of this novel. But it's a look at a truth about our world. Space has become a domain of warfare. I hate to say it. We think of the, you know, heavenly skies. They're not so heavenly. There's stuff up there. And the Chinese have put satellites into space that are basically killer satellites. They can go after our satellites, take them out. Same thing with the Russians. And we're getting into that game, too. We didn't just create a U.S. Space Force for nothing. It's a military force.
Well, and that kill switch that you're talking about is reminiscent of something called an EMP or an electromagnetic pulse. The technology certainly exists. Is that akin to what you meant by that?
I don't want to go into the details of what this kill switch is, but certainly EMP is a real threat. The ability to fry circuits in space is a very real danger. The development of high-powered microwaves, short of a great big EMP, high-powered microwaves can do significant damage. They can take drones, maybe aircrafts, out of the sky. They also, I watched a test of this, they can inject code through a couple brick walls from a distance in space. As a satellite orbiting nearby could inject malware. There's stuff that has been developed that makes space much more uncertain terrain. What's happening now, a simple way to put it, Tom, is preparation of the battlefield for a future conflict in space. That's what's going on now.
And do you think a lot of people who use the term deep state miss real hard work that folks in our intelligence communities are doing, and they're just dismissive because they buy into conspiracy theories, or I don't know, maybe they watch too many movies?
you know, in the movies, the CIA, the FBI are always bad guys. I think it's important for our country to have a good intelligence service and competent people. And, you know, if I get upset about the CIA, it's because I don't think they're doing a good enough job, that they're sometimes too big and bureaucratic. I don't worry about them being some kind of malign deep state that's running everything. Heck, I sometimes worry that they're not running the operations closest at hand. You know, I think we need an FBI that's going to protect us. I just recently wrote a column about the danger that ISIS-K, Islamic State terrorists from Central Asia, could slip across our unprotected southern borders. I'm totally with conservatives who think our border is a complete mess. They can slip across our border and cause damage like the ISIS-K operation in Moscow in March that killed 144 Russians. And I know, because I wrote a column about it, that Chris Wray, our FBI director, is really worried that people aren't paying attention to this danger. So in the world that I live in, the deep state is the least of the dangers that our country faces.
Certainly here in Arizona, border issues are front and center in our legislature and, you know, in our state politics. And it's also, of course, catapulting into the national sphere as well. David Ignatius writes a twice-a-week foreign affairs column for The Washington Post and is author of the new book, Phantom Orbit, a spy thriller. David, thank you so much for coming to Word. I appreciate your time.
That's great. Thank you, Tom.
You can find out a bit more about David Ignatius on our website, word.kjzz.org. We're back June 11th with our penultimate episode of the season. Thanks so much for listening to KJZZ's Word Podcast and also for supporting public radio. I'm Tom Maxidon.
Word.
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 Was the word.
Thanks for listening to Word, a KJZZ podcast about literature. You can find all episodes online at word.kjzz.org or wherever you get your podcasts.